Good evening. Welcome to the Solari Report. Today is Thursday, March 17th, 2011. I'm Catherine Austin Fitz, and I'm delighted you could join me this evening. Tonight, how would you feel if you were a highly successful author, you'd spent 30 years building a financially secure life and retirement savings, 1 minute, and the next minute you discover that it's all been stolen by Bernie Madoff? That's what happened to Jeanine Roth, best-selling author whose new book, Lost and Found, publishes next week and tells the story. It's a story about money, but it's also a story about how to successfully deal with adversity. And as you can see by the news this week, it's a skill we can all use. First, latest news in money and markets and your questions and ask Catherine. And let's go to the movies. I want to touch on a new documentary, Simply Raw, Reversing Diabetes in 30 Days. Following the Solari Report this evening, we have a special report. Dr. Laura Thompson of the Southern California Institute of Nutrition has agreed to join me for a special report on how to protect yourself against the harmful effects of radiation, as well as how to build an immune system to cope with environmental pollution and stress. I wanted to do that because there's so much misinformation flying around. I thought we'd get somebody who's really top-notch to just walk us through all the natural things we can do in the face of environmental pollution. Our theme tonight is There Is No Away. Some of you who know me know I often get frustrated with proposals as how you can solve everything by just moving away to a new place, and I just keep telling people there is no away. The events in Japan have proved that in so many ways, physically, financially, spiritually, Japan is right next door, as is every other place on the globe. Physically, radiation plumes can travel through the airstream and poison global air, soil, food supply within a relatively short period of time. I think many people have gotten an education about just how interconnected it is. Radiation can enter the water. We're watching ocean water used to cool down the reactors in Japan. Can poison water and fish again into the food supply. We have approximately 440 nuclear plants around the world, many in societies less capable than Japan, which is a country known for its excellence in engineering, and it's a chilling thought. So physically, we find that Japan is literally next door as we contemplate the possibility of a serious nuclear crisis. Financially, there's an intimate connection between Japan's economy, which is the third largest in the world, and savings and investment around the world. I'm going to talk a little bit more tonight about the yen carry trade, but it's an example of how dependent our capital markets have been on the flow of savings and investment and financial engineering out of Tokyo. If you look across the economy, you see how global the impact of events in Japan are going to be. Trade, Japan has been an exporter, not just of both capital and goods, one of the most important auto manufacturers in the world, very important to the high-tech industry. If Japan needs to repatriate a great deal of capital to deal with the construction and infrastructure needs, it's going to have an important impact. Insurance and reinsurance, the liabilities are going to be extraordinary on some players in insurance and reinsurance, both in America and in Europe. Nuclear power industry has been hit worldwide by cancellations, government reviews. Germany mothballed old plants. Switzerland canceled a new plant. We see France imposing additional restrictions on sales to countries deemed not to be capable of dealing with the kind of situation that Japan is dealing with. Oil, you know, I hate to say it, it's just like the Gulf. This is great for the oil and gas industry. They were struggling to keep the oil price up, and sure enough, the third largest economy is going to need a lot of oil this year to replace nuclear capacity. But the pressure to hold up or reduce nuclear capacity is going to increase the dependency on fossil fuel in the short run. More good news for Exxon and the big oil players. Finance is a big question. How much the unwind of the yen carry trade in 2008 had a profound impact, deflating asset values. That kind of carry trade has pumped up assets a lot. So that's a big question. Auto, Ford and GM, I had a blog post, will Ford and GM be the beneficiary? We know today GM announced today that it would halt production of pickups in Shreveport, Louisiana, because its supply of parts from Japan has stopped. Ditto in the tech industry. So much of the world depends on semiconductors and other parts from Japan. Construction, Japan will need it a lot. So as you walk across and you look industry by industry, you see economically and financially the impact of what's happening ripple everywhere throughout the globe. Spiritually, our hero of the week, millions if not billions of people are praying and weeping for the Fukushima 50. It's approximately 180 to 200 technicians and engineers who are risking and giving their lives working in rotating shifts to mitigate and end the nuclear disaster. Their courage and their sacrifice has raised very profound questions about leadership in a world that is watching and is grateful for their effort. Again, the impact, if they're not successful, the impact, if they hadn't stayed and dealt with it, could have been catastrophic. And it's a world that is, in contrast, fed up with leadership, which has been promoted for skills at harvesting the real economy, as opposed to building the real world and real economy. And I'm reminded very much of Michael Ventura, who wrote, "To proceed in the face of one's own nausea is the kind of courage no one ever told us about, but it's the courage we needed and still need." And it's certainly the courage that we've seen in the engineering and technician group this week in Japan. And so spiritually, physically, financially, what has happened is a reminder that there is no away and that our lives and future are intimately connected with billions of people around the globe. Money and markets. The money in the markets are defined by unknowns and the uncertainty of the unknowns. We put up a blog post that describes the extent to which the Dow Jones yo-yoed tremendously as headline after headline came after out of Japan. Let me talk about some of the big unknowns, because we're going to have to live with some uncertainty here for a while. One is, how bad will the crisis be? The latest headlines this afternoon indicate that they seem to finally be showing some success in cooling down the reactors, but a lot remains to be seen. And so how bad the immediate impact of the crisis is in terms of health and well-being in Japan, and even beyond if the radiation spreads, is a very important unknown, and I think probably the most important. There's another big unknown, and that is what caused the earthquake and the subsequent tsunami. There are many theories being contemplated by a wide audience of people. One is, of course, the natural phenomena along what's called the Ring of Fire, which is the sort of Teutonic plates that travel. It goes through Asia, up through Asia, and across down the western coast of the United States and into Latin America. And if you look at the Ring of Fire and what's happened in New Zealand and what's happened in Chile and if what's now happened in Japan, what you realize is there is a phenomenon occurring. So one is that this is a natural phenomenon. Earthquakes happen. It's the state of the Earth. Another is the nature of the Earth's rotation and planetary alignments and shifts in the planetary alignments that can impact the tides and the Earth's crust and the electromagnetic field. And so there's great interest in speculation there, and it's far from a simple topic and far from easy to get information about it. And then finally, there's guessing and questions about whether or not there was any kind of covert interference that might have exacerbated the natural phenomena. We have one question from a subscriber: Japan quake, Harper, natural, were there high volumes of short-selling money transfers out of Japan, etc.? There's no way to know, and the important thing to understand of all the theories as to what caused it, whatever you believe, whatever we try and infer from really much too little information, what comes out in all those theories is the likelihood for more earthquakes, including along the Ring of Fire. And so the nature of our world at this time, I talked in the year-end wrap-up about weird weather, But the nature of our world is that we're going to be dealing with difficult weather, and we're going to be dealing with phenomena like earthquakes, no matter what is causing them. And so if you don't have a disaster recovery plan, you really do need to develop one. And we need to contemplate being successful in a world like that. A third unknown is the ability of the Japanese to rebound. Historically, they've shown an astonishing ability to rebound in the face of earthquakes. Both Tokyo and Kobe have both experienced earthquakes, 1923 and 1995. Their ability to rebound from the nuclear bombs in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. So they are an astonishingly hardworking and disciplined people, and yet it's an older population this time around, and this is clearly coming on top of other difficulties, not to mention their dependency on foreign oil, particularly in the Middle East, so that events in the Middle East were causing enough concern and problems in Japanese industry. Remember, this is a country that has no materials really of their own and depends on exports to survive. Again, I mentioned the unwinding of the yen carry trade. A carry trade is when you borrow in one currency at a low interest rate and then take those funds and lend it in another currency at a higher rate. And the yen carry trade and carry trades have had a lot to do with pumping asset prices. They had a lot to do with financing the mortgage bubble and other big flows of capital. But needless to say, what we saw yesterday was the yen at a high against the U.S. dollar, and extraordinary under the circumstances. And what it spoke to is many, many investors trying to unwind the carry trade and real havoc in the Forex markets. Another big question, disaster capitalism, the extent to which these events will be used, as they always are, even assuming they're natural, to accelerate re-engineering and privatizations. A lot of things can go on when these kinds of events are happening, because they distract the audience. Everybody watches Japan and stops watching other areas. On other fronts, tensions in the Middle East grew. We have Saudi Arabian troops entering Bahrain, and we now have we had a no-fly zone declared in Libya. We now have the UN Security Council authorizing strikes in Libya. It's a way of Europe saying we want our energy. The politics of energy across the globe get ever more tense. We see continued recession and inflation in food and energy prices, producer prices up in the United States, but it's everywhere. It's globally. And we can expect it to happen more. What we're watching is the Bank of Japan printing almost $1 trillion, G20 saying it's okay to do, they'll meet tomorrow. And who knows how much the other Federal Reserve and the other central banks have printed. Certainly the Fed has affirmed that they intend to continue with QE2. So there's no reason to believe that inflation is over any time sooner. Despite the deflation that could have occurred in all the markets, we see gold got whacked down, but it's holding its own and coming back, and I think that reflects the real concern about the debasement. The dollar did not do well despite a lot of money flowing into the dollar for safety and into fixed income. That's something to watch. Wisconsin and Michigan and the state legislation that I talked about last week continues. These situations continue to be very troublesome. If you haven't read the Dylan Reed story that I wrote, Dylan Reed and the Aristocracy of Stock Profits, I recommend it to you. It's about prison privatization, but it describes the model that's now going to be used for education and many other state and municipal functions. And if you don't understand the model, I really encourage you to read that story. Congress has shifted the D-Day for the debt limit to April 8th, so the politics of that continue. Geithner, Secretary of the Treasury, has put forward another proposal on how to kind of re-engineer the mortgage markets, take Fannie and Freddie ultimately out of the game with a proposal for what's called covered bonds. It's simply more control for the New York banks. You move things out of Freddie and Fannie and much more into the big New York banks. it makes the systemic fraud much more manageable, and it's not a very attractive proposal. Finally, as I mentioned before, the oil industry had a great week. We had just about exhausted everything you could think of to keep the dollar, to keep the price of oil up, but it has the earthquake and what's happened in Japan and the impact on the nuclear industry has had its effect. Okay, very quickly, a couple questions and ask Catherine. There's a question about the Zurich Canton Bank's ETF. Very good question. I'm going to research and I will try and answer it next week. We also had a question on where is the list of the food movies. Our list of documentaries, it's called Our List of Documentaries and One Movie to Help You Organize Conspiracies to Grow Fresh Food, Finance the Gardeners and Farmers Who Do, and Inspire the Children You Love to Eat Fresh Food, is available at your subscriber control panel. If you go to the subscriber control panel, click on the archive of previous calls, and then click on the resource link for February 17th when we reviewed the top documentaries on that list. You can find it there, and I encourage you to hand it out, give it to your family and friends. And it's just a wonderful, watching those documentaries is a wonderful way to kind of inspire you and those you love to really revolutionize your relationship with food. Okay, well, it's my pleasure now to introduce you to a very special person. Janine Roth is a best-selling author. Many of you probably know her, have read her books about food and our relationship with food. As I described in my introduction, she literally was sitting in her kitchen one day, and I described this on her blog. Her husband, Matt, was sailing with friends in Antarctica. She answered the phone to discover that a life savings, hard-earned, had been stolen by Bernie Madoff. And what was so interesting about what happened next was that Janine, struggling with the devastation of that blow, decided to not let it get her down and finished her next book, became a top bestseller, New York Times bestseller list, phenomenally successful, and then turned around and wrote a new book, Lost and Found, which publishes next Tuesday. You can pre-order it at Amazon or the big sites. I've read it. It's fantastic. I can't recommend it to you enough. You can find it through her website. But she's here with us tonight to talk a little bit about Lost and Found, what she lost and what she found. So, Janine, are you with us?
Yes, I am, and thank you. It's such a pleasure to be with you.
Oh, well, tell us a little bit, before we get into Lost and Found, tell us about you and your work coming up to the topic of money. Tell us about you, because you've had a lifelong relationship with food.
Yes, now I consider myself somebody who's had two sorts of extreme relationships. One, and very extreme relationship with food, up until I really found my way through it and have been teaching and writing about it since then. And so that my first book was published in 82. And, of course, now the extreme and sort of stunning events that have happened with money and me. With food, I was crazed and anguished, and it was it, meaning my relationship with food, how I ate, what I ate, the size of my body, but mostly what I believed about myself and my self-worth because of the ricocheting up and down the scales was, I would say, the main source of, or the main expression of my suffering. It's more accurate to say that, for many, many years during which I gained and lost over 1,000 pounds. And
wow.
And that included dieting and fasting and spitting up and throwing up and getting addicted to diet pills and addicted to amphetamines and finally just deciding to stop eating and becoming anorexic and weighing 82 pounds for about a year and a half. And at some point, my resolve broke, and I gained 80 pounds in 2 months. And it was then when I was suicidal that I started sort of crawling my way through by realizing that the one thing I had never done, ever done, was try to decode my relationship with food and see how and why I was using it, what I was trying to say and express that I didn't know how to say any other way. And I never trusted myself, and I also never not dieted. So I had been on either a diet or a binge for 17 years. So I stopped dieting, and that was in about 1980. And then I started working with very small groups of people, you know, 10 people. I charged $1 a night for the Xeroxing to talk about what I was discovering, and then I started writing, and then, you know, it sort of just kept rolling on from there, just passionate about it because it's such a source of suffering for so many people, and more I'm interested in how we express the beliefs that we have about abundance and joy and value and worth and nourishment through what, when, and how much we eat. And so that's what I've been doing for all of these years.
And you've helped thousands and thousands of people rebuild and recreate the way that they are connected and relate to food.
And their bodies.
And their bodies, right.
Yes. And mostly themselves. Because, of course, there's a connection between the food we eat, what we eat, how we eat, and how we feel about ourselves. As I say, often that passion and joy and life force can't take root in exhausted, burdened, spaced out bodies.
Right.
So that's sort of the beginning. Yeah.
Well, tell us about Bernie Madoff,
mm-hmm.
and how you discovered that Bernie Madoff was not the successful investment guru that you had hoped.
I was, until the moment that I found out that we'd lost our entire life savings, which was almost every penny that we had, I was ignorant about who Madoff was. A friend of mine's father knew Bernie Madoff, and I was so ignorant and wanted to stay ignorant. I didn't want to know about money and the world of money. I was good at making it, but I felt like it was too complex to understand it, and I was never going to understand it anyway, and I didn't understand the value of connecting that time I spent making it with how I invested it. So I just thought that Bernie Madoff was a friend of my friend Richard's father, and that they put together this teeny little investment fund with Richard's closest friends and family, and that was what it was. And until he got arrested, I thought that's what the Madoff fund was. And when I found out, I was just sort of standing in the kitchen wondering what to have for lunch, and my friend Taj called and asked me if I was sitting down, and I knew she had just gotten a haircut from a new hairstylist, and I thought she was going to tell me she had gotten a haircut from hell. So I laughed, and I said, it can't be that bad, and then she said, Madoff is in handcuffs, and we've lost everything. And because Richard was Taj's ex-husband and all the people who Richard generously brought in, and I don't mean to say that facetiously, because Richard did not know about it either, and he and his family had been invested with Madoff for 30 years and had done very well. So it felt like a generous offer of Richard's, and everybody followed Richard's lead. By that I mean I had about 20 other friends and groups of families who also invested everything they had, much against everybody's advice about diversification. But nonetheless, we did that, and for me, I can't speak for them, but I can speak for me. It was out of ignorance and the desire not to think about it. And the absolute belief that Bernie Madoff, because it had been going on for 30 years with such good results, he didn't give Richard, you know, he was very subjective about who he gave, because it was all a Ponzi scheme anyway. He gave some people 50% returns, some people 6% or 5% returns. We mostly got in the 5 to 6 to 8% returns. That seems good enough.
Now, you tried several times to understand how the fund worked.
I did. But I didn't, I couldn't understand it. And, you know, it was called a split strike strategy. And I would sit and I would listen for a couple of minutes, maybe 10 minutes, and I just didn't, it sounded like gobbledygook to me. And I just didn't understand it. And I didn't, I wasn't willing to be what I call money dumb and just keep asking questions until I did understand it. And I just decided to give somebody else responsibility who seemed to look like he knew what he was doing and who had been doing very well for 3 decades. So it seemed like a good decision at the moment based on my desire to remain unconscious. And I just went forward with it, even though I didn't understand. And even though a couple of months before Madoff got arrested, I had a low-level feeling of anxiety all the time about being invested all in one place and not being diversified. And finally, we decided to take, I think it was 3/4 of our money out of the Madoff Fund. And we had to apply for that a couple of months before we could get it back. And we were due to get it on January 1st.
Mm.
So we were too late, but, we had kept it in. We started investing with Madoff 10 years before that.
Right. Now tell me, the way, one of the things your new book, Lost and Found, describes is how you gathered yourself after
right.
the news. And I would love for you to tell us about that, because I think it's an unbelievably important story of how you deal with adversity.
Yes. Well, I realized that, well, first of all, the first couple of days, I was absolutely devastated. I was shocked, devastated. I was terrorized because I did not know how we were going to live. You know, this was 30 years of both my husband's and my savings, our what seemed like our best earning years, and I didn't think we were ever, ever, ever going to make any or nearly as much back as we lost. And we had a mortgage on a house, and we had a home equity loan. So I was terrified, and my husband was out of reach, really. He was sailing with friends in Antarctica, and he was going to be gone for 2 weeks. One of the first things I did was call him. Well, the first thing I did was call a spiritual advisor of mine and tell her what happened, and she said to me, "Nothing of any value has been lost." And I went a little wild when she said that. I said, "How could you say that? What's the matter? You know, what do you mean? We've lost everything. I don't know how we're going to live." And what I was really thinking to myself when she said that was, now is not the time to be spiritual. And then we got off the phone. And, you know, she said, "You need to grieve, but, you know, I'll check back in with you later." And of course she checked back in with me every day, and then I realized I had to call my husband and find where he was, and he had left me an error, you know, this long sheet of numbers, each with different area codes for oceans, and he was sailing on 3 different oceans. And anyway, I finally managed to reach him, and after I told him what happened, And that happened quickly. And he said, oh, my God. And we both started to cry. He then had the presence of mind to say to me, Janine, we have to get off the phone. We are no longer the kind of people who can afford to talk on $10 a minute satellite phones. So we got off the phone immediately. And then I pretty much just stood in the kitchen for the longest time, and for the next few days was in shock. A friend of mine came to stay with me. She had also lost her money in Madoff. We cried a lot. And I saw that my mind went reeling off into regret, into shame that I had done what I had done, and you know everything from how could I have invested with in something that I didn't know and didn't understand, to how could I have invested all of our money in one place, and to what's the matter with me, and I'm dumb and I'm stupid, and I mean it was horrible, really, those cliffs of terror and blame and regret and shame. And I understood pretty quickly that if I was going to survive this intact and with any degree of sanity, I had to bring myself back to what I hadn't lost, not what I had lost, to what I still had enough of, not all the things that I didn't have enough of. And within, I would say, about the fourth day, I became vigilant about watching my mind go off into panic, because there was real panic there and hysteria, and bring it back to what I had in every single moment. And what I had, of course, was my body, the ability to breathe. I still had my eyesight. I still could hear, touch, see, feel. I could still drink my favorite chai out of my blue favorite flowered cup. I still had, you know, my dog who was still, you know, acting as if nothing had ever happened. I still had, as Jean, my spiritual teacher, said to me, everything that mattered and everything my life depended on in that way, from breath to breath. In this exact moment, which is what I did, I kept bringing myself to the awareness of what I had in this exact moment when I didn't go reeling off the cliffs of my mind of terror and anger and blame and regret and shame, when I didn't start thinking about the past or worrying about the future. There was a fierceness of bringing myself back to the sheer abundance and the sufficiency and the gorgeousness, really, of what I had. And it was stunning to see the effect that that had on my mind, on my consciousness, my presence, my happiness, really. Because I soon realized, after doing that hundreds of times a day, I began to feel very happy. And at some point, my mother called me and asked me how I was, and I said, fine, I'm actually really happy. And she said, sweetheart. And I said, what? She said, I have a question to ask you, and I won't judge you no matter what your answer is. And I said, what? And she said, are you on drugs? And because she said to me, how is it that a few scant days ago you lost all your money and now you're happy? And when you tell me what it is, could you bottle it? Because if you bottled it and sold it, you'd make a lot of money again. And but the thing is that it's free, that awareness, that willingness to pull the mind back. And as soon as I saw that, then that enabled me to have some kind of balance. I could be there for my friends. I could be objective. about what we actually needed to do. I had a sense of humor again. I could be compassionate for, you know, to people who really were struggling and suffering. I could also be curious about my relationship with money, which I had never been before, ever. I had a lot of beliefs about money. There's never enough, that the bottom line is you have to make a profit, that it only matters, you know, that you make the profit, not how you make the profit. I mean, I happen to do what I love to do, and it's my passion, I'm very grateful to that, but I had this money split in me, that money and focusing on money was spiritually bankrupt. So to put those two words together, that it was wrong, that money was dirty and sleazy, and, you know, I wasn't supposed to have it, and if I had it, I wasn't supposed to focus on it, because that made me a spiritually corrupt person, or made me, you know, politically incorrect. I didn't want to be one of the bad guys, like the Goldman Sachs bad guys. And so the only way I could sort of maintain an image of myself was to separate myself from the world of money and to just go completely unconscious about it.
Right. Now, you turned around. One of the things I have to point out, I linked to it from the blog post. There is a video of you talking to two New York reporters who do everything in their power to get you to start whining like a victim, and you won't, and they're deeply disappointed. And it's the funniest thing to watch, because to me, if you're going to solve anything, you need power. And as soon as you say, I'm a victim, you give away your power.
Yes.
And
right.
And I watched it, and I'll never forget watching that video, because I said, this is, you know, I need to use this as a training tool.
Right, because I felt so centered in myself, and also so aware that that from this vantage point, that losing my money brought to me, I was now able to have a different relationship with any of the money I had and or was going to have. And, you know, it didn't matter how much I had before. As I write in Lost and Found, we had nearly $1 million, and what perpetually felt as if we didn't have enough. I was always anguishing about, well, what are we going to do if one of us gets sick, and, you know, if we have to fly to Germany and get our blood cleansed, and if we get cancer, and if there's a horrible disaster, and you know, that's not enough, and we need more to retire on, and, you know, there was an inability that I had to take in what I had, to actually take it in, and to be conscious about it, to be curious about it, to even ask myself, what is this about that I'm always feeling like I don't have enough? I saw I was living in a trance of deprivation. And
right.
What was stunning to me was to have nearly $1 million and feel like I didn't have enough, and then to have nothing and feel like I did have enough. I understood then that enough, the way I'm talking about it right here, wasn't a quantity. It was a relationship to what I already had. And from that place, I could have an entirely different relationship with money and become financially literate, and which I have been making it my job to do since then. But I also saw how my relationship with money was directly related to my relationship with food, which I had never seen before. I had dieted and binged for years with food, and I saw that I budgeted and splurged with money. With food, I had rationalized things like, well, if it's free, it doesn't count, and if it's off somebody else's plate, it doesn't count, and if broken cookies don't count, because when the cookies break, the calories break. And there was a way that I did the exact same thing with money. If it's on sale, it doesn't count. If I amortize this thing over 3 years, then it's only 7.3 cents a day, and how could I afford not to buy it? And there were ways that I just kept saying, well, if I find money or if I'm given money, it doesn't count. So I saw that, and then I saw that the shame and the lying and the pretense that I had around food, this feeling of not deserving and not valuing myself, and therefore feeling ashamed, and that I wasn't really allowed to eat. Not really. I was only supposed to have dry salad and, you know, any kind of protein without the skin if I was allowed to have any protein at all. And that's how I felt about money. So that the questions of value and worth and abundance and scarcity and deprivation came up very strongly with both food and money, and I had never made that connection.
Now, you went on kind of, the way I describe it, it's a learning journey to talk to people about money.
Right.
And not only to understand your own, sort of unpack your own feelings about money, but explore what was going on in a world that would allow Madoff to exist.
Yes. I became fascinated and passionate about it, and I started talking to everyone. I made it my business. Well, you were one of the first people I called because I had heard you talk about precious metals a couple of years ago, and I loved what you said. And I had been following you more or less for a couple of years, but we hadn't ever talked. And so I wanted to talk to you, and I started talking to every financial person that I had heard about who I had some degree of respect for. I got in touch with them, and then I started reading a lot of books about money. But I also started talking to what I call regular people about money, friends I was out to dinner with, people I would meet in the grocery line, and I soon discovered that money and the subject of money was more taboo. People would rather talk to me about the intimate details of their sex lives than talk to me about money. And I couldn't believe it. But, of course, I could believe it because I was the same way.
Right.
You know, I was the same exact way. In fact, I did an exercise in my retreats where I had people do sentence completions. And there were things like, rich people are, money is, if I had enough money, I wouldn't be able to. And the things that people said, rich people are dirty, sleazy, corrupt, you know, the reason the earth is ruined, if I had enough money, I wouldn't be able to ask for help, feel like a victim, make connections with people, feel like one of the crowd. So I saw that there was a whole underworld of money that I had never been conscious of because I didn't want to be conscious of it. And then I made it my business to become conscious about it, to become interested in it, to ask myself about my beliefs about it, the sort of impressions from my childhood. And I had a pretty crazy childhood where money was concerned. You know, as I say in the book, when you depend on, my father was, you know, quite a successful businessman, but in many ways corrupt, and he ended up in jail, and then our first financial advisor ended up in jail, and then Bernie Madoff ended up in jail. And so there was a way that I definitely had basic impressions about what money was and what it wasn't, and beliefs about it that I realized I was going to act out again and again until I questioned them and saw they weren't true. Because I think what happens with the mind is the mind clings to something that it believes is true and keeps acting it out. But when you see it's not true, it begins to unfold and dissolve.
Right. But you have to bring it out. You have to.
Yes.
You have to lay it out. Now, I should point out, right in the middle of all of this, you finish and come out with your next book, Before Lost and Found, and it's a phenomenal bestseller. You're on Oprah twice.
Yes.
And you're walking around projecting, saying, well, you know, whatever is gone will come back around. And sure enough, it does.
Yes. Well, you know, I have to say, I didn't know whether it was going to come back again, but I knew that I was fine whether it did or didn't. And I knew that with this different kind of orientation towards my life and what enough was, and an interest in and curiosity about money, and really my conversations with you, Catherine, really helped me here, where I started seeing that I wasn't connecting and never saw the connection between what I valued and what I spent and the impact that I could have on the world or on the things that I certainly cared about, on my immediate community and my environment, by how I spent money. So that whole world opened up to me. And then, yes, Women, Food, and God became astonishingly successful.
And I must say, I've read, it's fabulous. So get Lost and Found, but you should get Women, Money, and God too.
Women, Food, and God.
I'm sorry,
but,
Women,
but
Food, and God.
One day I'll write Women, Money, and God.
I'm thinking ahead. They're both fabulous books.
Yes, right. I wrote Women, Food, and God was the distillation of 30 years, really, of my work with myself and my students with food and the relationship with food. And Lost and Found is Lost and Found was like standing in front of the burning bush and just being on fire and having things, when you're a writer, things ask to be written. And you sort of sit in your chair, I have this thing that I once read that Nora Roberts writes, she has a thing near her desk that, and it says ass and chair. And so I get my ass in my chair every day, and then I feel like it's not actually up to me what comes out. I just have to get myself there for it to unfold in. And I just felt illuminated by Lost and Found in a way that was deeply powerful.
Well, what did you learn in your learning journey in writing Lost and Found? What would your advice be to all of us? Not all of us have lost $1 million with Madoff, but everybody right now is. You know, it's rare that there's a person who's not losing something, whether it's money or something else. I mean, we live in a world of real adversity these days. What did you learn that will inform us about what we can all do to be successful in this environment?
I think, first of all, as you were saying at the beginning, there is no away. And we are living in a climate of fear and loss. You know, when this catastrophe and tragedy happened in Japan, it brought me back to the 1989 earthquake when I was living in Santa Cruz, and it was so intense to have to have the earth open up and have buildings fall in and have everything break in my house that could be broken and not know where Matt was. And it really was shocking. And to think that they had an earthquake and then a tsunami and now the nuclear situation, it's staggering. And I think that is an extreme, but possibly more and more common, as you mentioned, situation that we might be facing. And all of us, in some degree or another, are facing some kind of loss or fear of loss and a sort of low-level anxiety because of the state of the world right now. It's really extraordinary, I think, to be living on, you know, sort of on the edge of time is what I think about it these days, with so much at stake. And so I would say that the first thing, the very first thing is to come back to what you do have and to this moment as much as you possibly can, to get out of the nattering and the ranting of the mind, which can really lead you into panic and high anxiety, and in my own case, moments of hysteria, shame, blame, regret. And that leads nowhere good. That
right.
leads nowhere good. The mind in those circumstances is not your friend. And so I think the first thing is to develop a kind relationship with your mind so that you notice when you're going off those tracks, when you're going off into the track of shame, regret, anger, fear, hysteria, panic, and bring yourself back to your body, to this very body, to this very breath, to what you actually have in this moment, this exact moment, this exact moment, to your body breathing, to your feet on the floor, to the sensations in your arms and your legs, to actually the fact that you can see, to whatever you do have, because each of us has different things. Some of us
right.
are more challenged than other people, but if we're alive in this body, if we're not one of the, you know, 350,000 people that actually die today, we're still breathing, we still have our bodies and have our lives, to bring yourself back to that, to the goodness, to the fundamental goodness that's always there waiting for you to see it, waiting to be found, instead of focusing on what you might lose or what you have lost. From that place, you can begin a more objective sort of exploration about what you in your own particular situation need to do. If you're talking about financial, I would say, you know, what, you know, you've taught me to be willing to appear money dumb and to ask endless questions until you understand what you want to know. I'd say coming out of financial hiding is a huge thing to begin connecting. And I think this is more on the psychological level and also the financial level, to see what are the underlying and unspoken beliefs you have about money, about people who have money, about you when you have money, about what it's like to have and not have money, to actually tell the truth about your fear, your guilt, your shame, your debt to people you love. A good friend of mine, my best friend from high school, who has told me about every love affair she's ever had since we've been in high school, only told me when we lost our money and I started questioning myself and everyone else about money. It was the first time she told me she was $30,000 in credit card debt. She had never told me that. So to come out of hiding and tell the truth, question your beliefs about money. You know, something else that I've learned from listening to you and talking to you is to make money real and to connect what I value with what I spend and to know where my money is going. I think that's really, really important. I something else that's also important is to, in my case, to practice generosity and to give money away. I held on so tight because I came from such a place of deprivation and always felt like this last, you know, this dollar was going to be the last dollar that I was going to need if I ever was homeless. And so there was a holding on tight, and I've started to give money away. And it's been, I mean, I always gave money away, but not the way that I'm giving money away now. with a sense of wanting to give back, and a sense of sufficiency, and enoughness. So I would also say, to one thing that I think is important is set aside money for beauty and pleasure, and then make sure you spend it. Have a good time.
One of the things I loved in Lost and Found is your description of coming back again and again to this beautiful poem about kindness, and somehow you never let your heart get hard. I think when we experience loss, we let our heart get hard.
Yeah.
And that poem just keeps, it's so beautiful, and it just keeps, you keep going through it, and you just don't let your heart get hard.
Right. I that was one of the first things I did the day we lost our money, was memorize a poem called Kindness by Naomi Shihab Nye that I, she gave me the permission to reprint in Lost and Found. It was about losing, at through great devastation, you find kindness, and not separating yourself from people who are having a hard time. And I realized that I had kept myself in some way separate. And certainly there's nothing like losing everything to make you realize that you're not really so special after all.
Right.
And there's nothing more to lose. I mean, truly, there was nothing more to lose. So at that point, it was really time to look.
Now, tell us, Lost and Found comes out on Tuesday.
Yes.
Tell us what happens next.
Well, what happens next is that I hope millions of people read it and find themselves in it. I mean, that's my biggest hope, is that it impacts the cloud and the haze and the trance of deprivation and fear and anxiety that so many of us are in. So it comes out on Tuesday, and I think you mentioned, or I'll mention, that people can find out a lot more about this just by going to my website. And then I start a book tour, and I actually start a book tour on Sunday. So I fly to Boston, and I go to about 10 different cities in 3 weeks, and I appear on many, many, many different shows, TV shows, radio shows, but mostly I do a lot of events where I speak and meet people and read from the book and hear stories about money, and, you know, we have a chance to connect. So on
and
Thursday,
through the website, we can sign up for retreats and online workshops, too.
Yes.
So,
right.
So now, your website is JeanineRoth.com?
It is.
Okay.
And that you wait, the way you spell my name is G-E-N-E-E-N. Lots of G's, E's, and N's in there. JeanineRoth.com. Yeah, you can find everything out from the website. Yeah.
Well, I think this is going to be very, very exciting, because I don't want to get, one of my favorite lines in the book is the last paragraph, so I can't talk about it, because I don't want to give away the punchline at the end of the book. But I think it's one of the things that the book teaches us is that we have the power to really change things.
Yes.
But it requires, you know, it's not an easy or simple thing, because we're talking about fundamental change. You know, the Madoffs of this world can exist if we allow them.
Yeah.
If we say, you know, in other words, one of the things that's so amazing about Lost and Found is the extent to which you have taken personal responsibility for, you know, and recognize the fact that in America, all of this crazy financial business can't go on if we hadn't, in one way or another, gone along with it.
Yes, and I think that was the amazing thing for me to see, that it's possible to come out of hiding. It's possible to actually empower yourself and that what goes on in part because we allow it to go on. And because, you know, a friend of mine who I sent a copy of the book to said to me, I am absolutely shocked. I'm just like you, pre-Madoff. I have blinders. She said, I have blinders on about money. My husband likes to manage my money, and I let him. I think of money as being a foreign country where everybody speaks a different language and eats yucky food. And someday I'll visit it, but not soon.
Oh, well, Janine, it's just really been wonderful. I encourage everybody to get Lost and Found, read it, and to check out Janine's website, the workshops, the retreats, everything. It's just a wonderful exploration, and it brings us back to the place where our power begins.
Yes.
So
yes.
It's a real contribution, and it's just been a delight to have the opportunity to talk with you about money and as you've been on this journey. So we wish you Godspeed and all the best of luck with the book tour. I think it's going to be a huge success.
Thank you, Catherine.
That's my prediction.
Thank you for everything.
Oh, thank you.
Doing and giving. Yes. You've helped me so much.
Oh, I'm so glad. Well, you have a wonderful time and enjoy that book tour. Okay, so very simply, I want to make a comment on Simply Raw, which is our movie this week. It's a documentary. It's called, actually the full title is Simply Raw, Reversing Diabetes in 30 Days. It's an independent documentary, and it chronicles the 30 days of six Americans with diabetes who switched to a diet consisting of vegan, organic, uncooked food, and in the process all are able to come off their insulin and medication, except for one who reduces it radically. It's a bit slow-moving. It can be painful to watch, but it's a powerful reminder of what is possible if we eat fresh, wholesome food. And if you have diabetes or know someone who does, it's something you really want to take a look at. It really is a must-watch. And when we redo our list of documentaries, again, I call it our list of documentaries in one movie, to help you organize conspiracies to grow fresh food, finance the gardeners and farmers who do, and inspire the children you love to eat fresh food. When we redo the list, we'll put it on it because it definitely deserves to be there. And again, you can find that at at the control panel under the February 17th archive. It's the resource for the February 17th. Okay, well, I'm hoping that Dr. Laura Thompson has joined us. Laura, are you with us?
Hello, Catherine.
Hi, good evening, and I can't thank you enough for doing this. As I was watching this week events unfold in Japan and reading a phenomenal amount of information, misinformation flying across the Internet, I said, you know, we have to get Laura Thompson back on the Solaria Report, and we have to do a special. We have to do it this week, so I appreciate your taking time in your evening to do it.
Oh, you're welcome. I appreciate you asking me.
Well, we want to talk tonight about how to mitigate against the effects of radiation. The president has just announced today that they do not expect radiation or any impact to people in North America. But I think certainly what's happened has brought questions into people's mind. They're concerned. And we're also concerned about the fact that there, you know, if we do have possibilities of earthquakes, there are a lot more nuclear facilities in the United States, and this could happen again. So I think it's important to talk about. But maybe before we start, if we could just talk a little bit about you and your background, maybe if you could describe yourself.
Oh, okay. Well, let's see. My degree is PhD in Nutrition and Human Behavior, Body-Mind Connection. I initially started using naturopathic, I guess the new word is technologies, 23 years ago, and basically had a practice that focus on very simple techniques to help people improve their health, things that they can incorporate to, now that I look back on it, you know, one of my focuses is to help people have more control. And one thing led to another, and because my background was in body-mind medicine, I gravitated toward hormone balancing because the hormones are the sort of the connectors between the internal world and the external world, and stimulators and modifiers and balancers of brain function. And so my practice is quite a bit of hormone balancing for men, women, and children. We use a stress hormone protocols for kids as well, kids' attention deficits, autism, allergies, asthma, et cetera. But, of course, I interweave the nutrition because that's the baseline. That's what we're left with, what we eat, and like I said before, what we can control in our lives. I have the Southern California Institute of Clinical Nutrition, SCICN for short, in Carlsbad, California, and which is basically where I go every day. I have other practitioners that I work with, but my practice is largely long distance. So about 75% of my patients are out of state. I have patients in Europe and, you know, all over the U.S. Because my focus has always been, let's see what we can help the masses with. I always feel like one-on-one is good and in my community is good, and, you know, that's all important. But, you know, how could people be helped in a bigger way? So having a long-distance practice has been really beneficial and rewarding for me.
And I should say, I'm a patient of yours, and I would describe my relationship with you is I believe you saved my life.
Oh, wow. That's a big statement. No, you saved your life. I just helped.
Okay, well, it's amazing how many dead ends you can go down when you're willing to work hard to save your life, but you're not sure what to do. Anyway, tell us about radiation and what it does to the body.
Well, you know, I mean, obviously, I know your clients and the people who are listening are all probably a cut above as far as being able to amass information and be intelligent about it. But you know, I'll just say, you know, we deal with radiation every day. I'm sitting in front of radiation right now, and so, you know, we already have an incredible exposure of radiation, just with the phones and the microwaves and all that, and then plus we have diagnostic tools and X-rays and MRIs and that kind of thing. And I will put someone on a radiation detox product or program, even in those kind of situations. You know, people who use a lot of cell phones or have, you know, a lot of cell phone use, people who live near power plants, people who fly a lot, that type of thing. I'll put them on sort of generalized radiation protection programs. But, you know, of course, what we're talking about here is for us, I mean, especially here on the West Coast, we're talking about, kicking it up a notch. And, you know, I guess what I call long-term low-level radiation, as far as I know, it's hard to tell, but...
Right.
And so that would be cumulative, and that could affect, you know, any cell in the body. I know a lot of the focus in the natural health media has been on the thyroid and iodine, which, you know, is important to protect the thyroid. But, it, you know, to me, it's not really the big picture. The big picture is protecting the body from degenerative processes, which is pretty much what happens with radiation. It causes degeneration of the cells, and that leads to disease, or can lead to disease. And of course, a lot of people think of the word cancer because that's the word that's batted around most with thinking about radiation. You know, of course, if it's more extreme, people get burning and nausea and, you know, all kinds of other problems. But, I mean, do you think, I don't think we're dealing on that level right now.
No, I don't. My assumption from just reading about 1,000 reports is that we don't really have a reason right now to be concerned in North America.
Mm-hmm.
I do think that with as many nuclear plants around the world as we have, and as well as nuclear weapons, that the chances of dealing with a nuclear event or meltdown over the next 20 years are reasonably good. So I do think it's something that we need to understand.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, the funny thing is, Laura, I've seen so much fear this week,
mm-hmm,
that I almost think the most important reason to understand it and know how to prepare is so that you don't have to be afraid.
Exactly.
You know, it's really funny, about a couple years ago, because we're required by law, we did a disaster recovery kit, and I can't tell you, it was very time-consuming and expensive and everything, but ever since then, I've been delighted, because every time there's an event or a problem or what, I'm not worried, because I have a plan,
mm-hmm,
and I have a way of dealing with it, and we're prepared. And I think it's the same thing, whether it's radiation poison or any of the other many kinds of environmental pollution. If you understand it, if you know what the words mean, if you know what to do, even if it's a remote possibility, then the sort of terror that is, to me, is much of it is manipulation, can't impact you. It can't
right.
get through, because you have an intellectual barrier.
I think part of the problem is that people, well, obviously people think the worst, or they're brainwashed to think that the worst is going to happen, but that, you know, like you said, they don't have a plan, and on even that could be on the most minuscule of levels, and they've given up control of their bodies, and they don't
right.
really know that they can, that they have power, and they have the ability to create a mighty fortress.
Right.
And so that's what I'm hoping to bring to people, the, you know, empowerment, really, to, you know, to see that the balanced bodies, balanced minds, and how to do that are going to help to dispel the fear and take action, not just because of this, but maybe this is a wake-up call to take action in general on another level, you know, kicking that up a notch.
Well, how would we build our health? How would we build our immune system to protect against a whole array of potential environmental pollution?
Well, you know, it's important to look at where is the immune system. I mean, the immune system, it seems like nebulous in a sense, because it's not a single organ.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't really even know what, you know, most people don't know what constitutes the immune system. Well, first of all, 60% of the immune system is in the digestive tract. So right there, you have a good place to start. And this is what I teach all my patients. The most important thing, you know, for protecting yourself and getting your immune system strong is healing the gut, healing the intestinal tract. And so what does that mean? It means, you know, I look at destroyers or invaders or things that challengers as in three categories. And those three categories are allergens, which we'll keep on the back burner today because it's not necessarily as, you know, apropos. But it does, those do, you know, deplete the immune system, take energy from the immune system of persons not addressing their allergens, food or environmental. And then you have infections. That's a big player in why a lot of people's immune systems are low or weak, because they have cumulative multiple infections that may or may not manifest in any way that they can know that they have an infection, whether it be digestive or colds or flus or whatever. But multiple infections that they don't know they have, because it may be that no one strain or species or bacteria or virus is actually, you know, in a high population. But you put them all together and you get something that's draining or straining the immune system. The immune system is focusing on that because that's its job, and so therefore it's not going to be available to be alert for something like what we're talking about. So we have allergens, we have infections, and then we have toxins. And toxins could be anything from chemicals, household products, to radiation, to heavy metals. I know you know about that. And and pesticides and, you know, just all the different ways we get toxins in. And so we're already dealing with a lot of things. We're already dealing with what I see in most of my patients is compromised immune function. And so starting with the digestive tract, because that's where a lot of them go. You know, we swallow
right.
them, we take them in by air. And healing the gut. So that means, you know, monitoring the bowel movements. You know, 1 to 3 bowel movements a day is the more you eat, the more the bowels should move. 2-3 meals a day should result in at least two bowel movements a day. And then, of course, you know, anybody who watches Dr. Oz even talks about the S-shaped bowel movement or the size of a large banana would be one way to monitor the gut. Another way is, do you have gas? Do you have cramping? Do you have bloating? You know, those are symptoms that, you know, of course, a certain amount of gas is normal, but those are symptoms that there's something going on. It's kind of like your body is tapping you on your shoulder with these
right.
little inklings. And so those types of symptoms indicate that actually the immune system and the intestinal tract is being compromised. So how do you heal them? Well, one way is to feed the immune cells, which is called the GALT, the gut-associated lymphoid tissue in the intestinal tract, to help to repopulate these white blood cells, and because this is part of your immune system, with things like colostrum, which you can get in liquid, you can get it in powder, you can get it in capsule form, with aloe vera, liquid food-grade aloe, actually helps to build the immune system, but it also helps to heal the little tears in the digestive tract. And when we have these tears in the intestinal lining, that's what causes us to become more vulnerable to things like radiation, because that is when the whole body is exposed. The digestive system is sort of built like a fortress. You know, in a sense, you think that the intestinal lining is equivalent to your external skin. It's protecting the rest of the body from things that
right.
should not be going into the bloodstream. And so when there are the little tears, which are called gut leakage, or some people call it leaky gut syndrome, that's you know, major awareness of the fact that your immune system is compromised. So healing the gut is of major importance for, you know, this situation that we're talking about.
Now, does radiation increase the level of heavy metals?
Well, you figure it depends on the type of radiation, but you're dealing with toxic. They're not necessarily heavy, but they're toxic
right.
metals. Yeah. I mean, they're a little bit different. You know, you're dealing with strontium, you're dealing with cesium, you're dealing with iodine. You know, these
mm-hmm.
are all minerals or metals that can become toxic. Or can damage the cells. So, for instance, doing a metal detox is one of the, you know, that's one of the strategies that I take patients through after having radiation exposure. Because it's going to chelate to, you know, indiscriminately.
Right.
So then as far as the immune system is concerned, we want to look at the leader, the king on the throne, which is your thymus gland, which is in the upper chest. And that is part of that's actually a hormone organ. It's an organ that makes a gland that makes hormones, and those hormones then stimulate different parts of the immune system to do what it's supposed to do. And so we actually sometimes even give thymus glandular, you know, in capsule or tablet form to some patients to help to strengthen the thymus gland. And I think that's going to be really important for a lot of people with ongoing radiation exposure, even at the low level, because most people's immune systems are compromised, and so one of the ways to get it up and running is to feed the king.
Right.
So you have then the gut, you have the thymus, and then you have all the lymphatic vessels in the body, which, you know, they're hard to see. They're really tiny vessels, kind of like your circulatory system, except very small, and they go from the ankles all the way up into the sinuses. And this system carries lymphatic fluid and white blood cells, which also help to detoxify, or they're sort of, it's sort of like the garbage disposal system for your cellular waste. So, so you take in a toxin or you breathe in radiation or whatever it is, and if it gets, you know, into the body because the immune system is weak or because the digestive tract is weak, then then it gets into your cells. So, okay, does that mean, this is where I think a lot of people, where the fear lies. Once you get it, how, you know, does it stay there? Most people don't think you can get rid of it. But of course you can.
Right.
Of course you can. And so it's just a question of keeping these immune organs strong and helping the lymphatic system do the drainage, which is, you know, basically allowing your garbage disposal to work properly so that the lymph vessels then take the toxins out through your detoxifying organs, which are the liver, the lungs, the skin, the kidneys, and the bowel. And so how do you emphasize the strength of the lymphatic system? Well, one way is exercise, another way is massage, another way is trampolining. Some people actually get special lymphatic massage. In my field, we use special lymphatic homeopathics, which are called drainage products, and they help to get down to the minuscule levels and help the cells actually, you know, take your garbage out.
Right.
You know, imagine if your house is closed and you can't take the garbage out, and that's what happens with a lot of cells. Excuse me. So all you have to do is, you know, let the door open and take the garbage out,
right,
and then your body will, you know, handle it, excreting it.
So let's say I'm a really busy person, and I've been ignoring, you know, my health. I've just been busy and working hard and whatever. And I realize, you know, maybe given what's going on in this world, I need a better health as a better defense against, you know, the just sort of the, I call it environmental pollution, but all of these things that could happen. What's the first thing I do?
Well, clean up the diet. Eliminate toxins, chemicals, food colorings, sugar, things that cause your body to become weak. And that's, again, that's where I always like to help people, you know, give them something they can do on a daily basis so they know that they have control. They feel like they're really, it's so empowering when I speak to my patients, talking to them about making day-to-day changes, how you could just hear it in their voice, you know, the excitement. You know, I eliminated coffee. I've been off coffee for 3 weeks, and boy, you know, my brain is so much clearer. I don't have headaches anymore, that kind of thing. So cleaning up the diet and going organic as much as possible to avoid the xeno hormones, the pesticides, that type of thing. Focusing on the foods that you know make you feel good. I mean, sitting and actually thinking, does this make me feel good? Because a lot of people don't even really key into the energy of their food.
Right.
And then on top of it, they deplete the energy by microwaving it. I mean,
right.
That, I mean, take the microwave in our house, because it's, you know, we rent and it was just here. It's a cabinet for me.
I gave my microwave away. I don't have one.
I would like to take it out. I asked our property manager if we could, and we couldn't. So anyway, but don't use the microwave. I mean, people use the microwave to heat up their water. I mean, how long does it take to boil water? Anyway, and that's radiation too, you know. So get rid of that stuff. And
what about testing? Because one of the things that I found that you got me to do was to do significant amounts of testing that really helped me understand, well, where am I?
Yeah. So for the topic that we're talking about, because I have probably, you know, 15 different tests that we have available in different areas, but I'd say one of the most important tests, actually, now that I'm thinking about it, for just kind of real comprehensive would be, we do biofeedback testing with saliva and a hair sample. And my biofeedback practitioner is basically what she does is it reads the sort of the DNA, sort of like, sounds like CSI, I know, but and it looks to see, you know, covers all of the bases, everything from allergens to infections to toxin, toxic overload, to weak and strong organs and hormones and brain neurotransmitters and all that. And so I always see, you know, if there's been radiation exposure, it will come up in the test results. And, you know, and it never fails. You know, I was talking to a 23-year-old the other day, and it came up in her biofeedback test that she had radiation exposure. Of course, she flipped out because of this thing that's happening now. And I said, is there any way that you could, you know, are you like a heavy cell phone user, or, you know, do you eat a lot of microwave foods? And going through all the things that could possibly be giving her radiation, and then no. So I'm thinking, well, I just kind of put it aside and went on to another topic. And then all of a sudden, about 5 minutes later, she bursted out. She said, X-rays. I've had so many X-rays this year because I've broken this, and I've had, you know, she had pelvic problems. And anyway, so the biofeedback testing is very profound for finding things that you don't know you have, things
right.
that you don't feel symptomatic from. Metal testing through the urine could be really profound for toxins. Because a lot of times we don't feel these things, you know.
One of the things that amazed me, because as you know, I've spent years with your help detoxing heavy metals,
mm-hmm.
and you know, I drive around the country a lot, and I by detoxing heavy metals, I saw the profound change in my sort of mental acuity and energy, and you know, it was just a profound, profound change. It was a little bit like coming out of the grave and, you know, turning young again. And as I drive around the country, I just see, it looks to me like everyone is very toxic, and a lot of it looks to me like it's heavy metals.
I think you're right. I think they're very subtle. They, you know, accumulate little by little, year after year. We're not educated to know what it feels like to have metal overload. You know, we think of something extreme, you know,
right.
But basically most people don't have an extreme situation. They just have an overload and accumulation. And so you have to think that metals have an accumulation for fat, have an affinity for fat tissue. So the brain is 60% fat. You know, they're going to go to the brain, they're going to go to, you know, the liver, they're going to go to your, you know, external, you know, body fat, they're going to go to the gonads, they're going to go to the ovaries, the testes, the prostate.
Right, and the body's going to create fat to protect you.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
Right.
They're sequestered there, but unfortunately they can wreak havoc down the road, especially with overload. So doing metal testing can be very profound for someone's health, especially for someone who might have something going on where they're saying, you know, I'm doing all this stuff and nothing's happening. you know, or, you know, they don't feel better and they're taking a lot of action. Well, it could be metals because, like I said, it's very subtle. And I'm going to be doing a lot more metal testing in the next 6 months, I'm sure, because, again, we're getting this, you know, these little bits over a long period of time. And it might seem insignificant, but, you know, the body's going to hold on to it if the immune
right.
system isn't strong enough to kick it out.
So biofeedback, heavy metals, what about neurotransmitters?
Neurotransmitter testing is good. I wouldn't say it's necessarily as appropriate for a a conversation about toxins. However,
right.
if you know you have brain fog and you have long-term low-level radiation exposure, and you know you use pesticides or you did when you were younger or whatever it is, toxic overload, that can affect the output of the neurotransmitters in the brain, which control your moods, your emotions, your cognitive function, your ability to sleep, you know, your ability to be motivated, depression, joy, the whole thing. So I would say that's secondary testing, but unless somebody wants it, unless they, you know, they say they're depressed or they have insomnia, they want to get off antidepressants or anti-anxiety medications, then I would definitely do that test. That test is done through the urine, and it checks serotonin and dopamine and GABA and adrenaline and all the brain chemicals that we want to look at.
What now, there's been an awful lot of, I don't know, it just seems like every time you turn around, somebody's telling you to take potassium iodine.
Mm-hmm.
What's that about?
Well, the community that recommends potassium iodide is basically one-track-minded. And although I sold probably 20 to 40 bottles of iodine today in my office because people just want to, you know, cover bases. But the whole thing about iodine is really a focus on the thyroid and the fact that when people have radiation exposure, because of the inclusion of iodine, and you know, as a radioactive element, this would be iodine 131. That the iodine is crucial to the thyroid. It's a mineral that the thyroid uses to make its hormones, and the body needs to uptake it daily. And basically, from your diet, you know, if you eat a wide range of fruits and vegetables, you're getting iodine. Now, what happens is if the thyroid is not saturated with enough iodine at the time of exposure to radiation, then the body will uptake the radioactive iodine. It's, you know, it's just going to take whatever it can get. And so the whole idea of taking potassium iodide or ammonium iodine or the various forms of iodine that are like probably everyone's out of stock of now on the internet, the idea there is to saturate the thyroid a day or two before exposure so that the body does not uptake the radioactive form of the iodine.
Right.
The problem comes with, you know, nothing is good for everyone. Even though I know that, you know, I know that they gave it out in Japan, which, you know, that you got to do what you have to do whatever you have to do. But, you know, iodine, some people are allergic to it. Some people have thyroid conditions where they're on thyroid medications, which this could interfere with. This could cause a person to become more hyperthyroid if they're already on medication because the body will take the iodine to make more thyroid hormone. And so people could have heart palpitations. They could get very hyper, fidgety, not sleep. So, you know, actually the company that sells the iodine that my office uses, they recommend, it's a liquid form, they recommend 25 drops for 3 days for an adult. Well, I'm telling my patients 1 to 3 drops because, you know, that's a high dose. And
right.
Who knows, you know, people are probably getting all kinds of information to take high-dose iodine. I think the more important thing, since you know, we're not dealing with a mushroom right over us right now. The more important thing is to deal with how your body's going to detoxify with long-term, low-level exposure. That's where my focus is.
Which we're getting now.
Which we're getting anyway. Yeah.
Right.
We're getting it anyway, so this isn't anything new. It's just probably, there's going to probably be a period of time where it's going to be more than it has been. But I will say that it is good to have, and you probably know this, potassium iodide or ammonium iodine or some sort of iodine around for some problem. In fact, the hormone lab that I work with, the lab that does the testing that I do, they make custom designed hormone creams. They actually have a potassium iodide cream that they're, you know, selling in very small amounts for just one day of saturation, for to saturate the thyroid with, you know, exposure. So it's good to have something around in case. But I think that the whole thing has been blown out of proportion, and unfortunately, that's all some people are doing. When in actuality, it's the other things that we're talking about that are more important.
Well, what happens, you know, and it comes to each one of us at a different time, but what happens is whether it's the swine flu vaccine or autism or Alzheimer's or chronic fatigue or, you know, a nuclear crisis, suddenly what we realize is even though all these things are invisible, our bodies are now dealing with a level of environmental pollution that we never, you know, we were never raised or trained to deal with that.
Mm-hmm.
So we're dealing with levels of stress and toxicity, which is, you know, it's a whole new ball game.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened to me when I met you and sort of studied and figured out, okay, I've got to get radical, is, you know, it was a real paradigm shift for me. And I realized, you know, I need to get really radical because this is war. And
yeah.
I need to win at war, you know. And
yeah.
it's terrible and it's horrible, but, you know, I can do this. I can do this. And now as I drive around the country and I look at so many people struggling with unbelievable, and it is, it's environmental toxicity, I just so want to tell them, look, you can beat this, but you have to, you know, we can't just assume that we can, what produced a healthy person 20 years ago is not what produces a healthy person now. And there's a real need to shift and get radical about this stuff.
I so agree. I think people have the ability to get a lot of information, and the overload of information is almost paralyzing.
Right, it is.
So,
it is.
And you know, it's good that, you know, that information is available. I think it's just important to find out what it is that you need, because it's never the same for any two people.
Yeah, everybody's different. That's the thing. Everybody's unique. And so what works for one person, you know, what works for me is not going to work for the next person.
Mm-hmm.
And that's sometimes where I'm very reluctant to. I finally broke down and got tired of answering the question, so I put up a blog post called Catherine's Cleansing. It's up on the blog if anybody wants to see it, but it talks about some of the different things I've done that were successful, including a link to your website, which we also have up at the top of the blog now for this conversation. But maybe if you could just take another minute, Laura, and explain how we find you and your team at Southern California Institute of Nutrition.
Okay. Well, the website is drlaurathompson.com. That's T-H-O-M-P-S-O-N. The same URL is redirected. www.scicn.com. That's Southern California Institute of Clinical Nutrition. And we have an 800 number, which is 800-608-5602. And my staff there is pretty friendly. And and we do give a free 15-minute consultation. Kathy at my office has been with me for 11 years, and she knows my whole routine. So she likes to connect with people and figure out what's going to be the best path for them and help them out with prices and options, you know, testing options and that kind of thing. So that helps people get started, because that way they can say, okay, well, that sounds good to me. And so those are the main ways to get a hold of us. I did want to say before, I don't know if you had any other questions, but I thought I would just give people a rundown of some types of products that would be good.
Oh, great. Yes, definitely.
Okay. Well, we talked about the iodine, which is, you know, not necessarily a major focus, especially after this weekend, although there are other forms of iodine which I think are are really good on an ongoing basis, which would be your seaweeds. So using different types of the seaweed, the wakame, the nori, that type of thing, but also kelp and dulse, which you can, you know, just sprinkle on salad, or green drinks usually have some level of seaweeds in them. And then there are concentrated, I carry one product called Arctic Alginate, which has Irish moss, and it has the alginates in the algaes, in the seaweed, are components that bind to toxins. So the seaweeds with the highest amount of alginates, or the green algaes with the highest amount of alginates.
So spirulina, wood.
Well, you know, all the greens are good. I mean,
right.
People should be taking greens every day. Everybody should be taking spirulina, blue-green algae, chlorella. But the brown algae is the one that has the most affinity for radiation. And, you know, they use different words for that. Modifilin, M-O-D-I-F-I-L-I-A-N is what name of one product. And then they have the Fucosan, F-U-C-O-S-A-N. They're just different, I guess, brand names for the type of alginate.
There's one natural, and it's brown algae, that was developed specifically for the people who had worked at Chernobyl.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know the name of that one?
Yeah, that's the Laminaria japonica.
Uh-huh.
Laminaria japonica, that's the Latin term. And that is the brown algae, that's the one I was just talking about.
Right.
It has those brand names. Then there's Irish moss. One of the products I carry has a lot of alginate with Irish moss in it. And all of these are going to have a little bit of iodine as well. But they're also going to have metal chelators in them. So they're great for not just radiation, but your general metal toxicity. So looking at your greens, the seaweeds, you know, of course, eating greens, can't beat those.
Right.
Taking algaes by capsule or powder. My favorite algae is the super blue-green algae. That doesn't have as much iodine in it, but it's a great metal chelator. So that's one classification. And then, you know, you want to go with, I put them in sort of one category, gut healers, binders, and detoxifiers. So these are different types, non-green forms of detoxifiers. It would be anything from charcoal, like say somebody had an exposure to radiation or some other type of toxin, really extreme, you know, have charcoal around because that's a great binder of toxins.
Right.
Then there's the calcium bentonite clay, which some people use for colon cleansing. I decided just to start doing colon cleansing this week, you know, a couple of days ago, just to, I guess, follow my own advice. got to do that. Got to be a good example. And then aloe, as I mentioned before. And I carry a lot of products that have combinations of all these. But, you know, you can get things from your health food store, or if you're working with another practitioner, then, you know, they probably have their own inventory of products. Then there's a classification of immune fortifiers, things that break down tumors, DNA repairers, antioxidants, you know, that category, which
mm-hmm.
would be basically your immune fortifiers. So my favorite one, and the one that I'm going to be using with most of my patients now, in these next few weeks especially, is going to be green tea. And I have a product that I use called Green Tea Nano, and that helps to contain tumor growth. It's great for scavenging, you know, the free radicals that are caused by any type of exposure. And we actually have a special, I know you know about this, Catherine, we have a special mud pack that we use the green tea to make a paste of with the mud pack. And people can actually put it over their thyroids. They could put it other places too, but I'm saying the thyroid because so many people are concerned about the thyroid.
Now, you know, this is funny, but I consider this mud pack better than sex. But fact, I have a blog post about it because I finally got tired of explaining. Now, I was doing it with a heavy metal nano, not the green tea nano, but so I have to try the green tea nano,
mm-hmm.
but I have to tell you, these mud packs, you know, only, and I just say this for everybody listening, if anybody in the world had told me to do this other than Dr. Laura Thompson, I would have laughed out loud. And only, it's a matter of my respect for you. I said, if she says this will work, I will do it. And I can't tell you how ridiculous I felt getting out and putting mud pack all over myself and sitting in the sun, and it's just magical. It is just magical. So
so many people comment on that. I'm so glad you believed me.
Well, you know, I didn't. I just said, okay, I'm going to do it.
Oh, okay,
because
right.
She said to do it, but I don't believe it's going to work. But I'll do it, you know. So I, you know, I'm a prototyper, and I kind of feel like, you know, life begins outside of your comfort zone. But I would not have done, I mean, I did it, but I didn't believe it was going to work. And when, you know, and of course I had to do it on multiple, you know, day after day after day. And then when it worked, not only did it worked fantastically. And what we're describing is pulling heavy metals out of the thyroid. And, you know, my energy doubled and tripled. It was incredible.
Mm-hmm.
And so I couldn't believe it would work, but I will tell you that it did.
So that's one way to go. And then, of course, drinking green tea. You know, they say that, you know, drinking 20 cups of green tea a day. I know they've done experiments with people with radiation exposure, and the ones that drank the 20 cups of green tea a day, they're probably flying, but had much less damage. But this product is like one teaspoon is equivalent to, you know, like 50 cups of green tea or something, without
right.
the caffeine, by the way.
Right.
And then you have your antioxidants, like something like dihydrolipoic acid. Now, a lot of people know about alpha-lipoic acid, but this is like 100 times more concentrated than alpha-lipoic acid. And this is also in a nano form, which is the whole idea of it is it gets absorbed really well into the body and into the cells. And so this will help to protect, you know, and help to actually repair DNA as well. So you have things that protect, and you want also have things that can repair. And then there's, I'll just say one more thing, and that is, well, you want to, you know, of course, think of your antioxidant vitamins like vitamins A, C, and E. I'm giving higher doses of vitamin C in the next few weeks, like 3,000, 5,000. And then there is a new cream available, which is a glutathione cream. Glutathione, a lot of you probably know, is a premier antioxidant. Helps the body to scavenge the free radicals, the bad guys that cause damage. And so this is a glutathione cream with, you know, sulfurated amino acids in it, which also help to bind to metals and all kinds of other toxins, and SOD for anti-inflammation. And the idea of it being a cream is that it actually absorbs. You get much more of the nutrient or the substance that way because they're attached to these lipids that help with absorption into the body without going through the digestive tract and losing a lot of it. And so they actually used this cream with people who've gone through radiation therapy and chemotherapy, and people, like, for instance, going through radiation therapy did not get any burns. The chemotherapy patients did not lose their hair. So
wow.
They've now been, you know, using this cream now, and people are starting to use it now. So, and then one other thing that I wanted to say, and something that's really easy, especially for that person that you talked about who's on the run and doesn't really have a lot of time to do things, I would say what that person should do would be maybe some kind of a bowel cleanse product at least once a week, and really improve their food and, you know, limit their chemical intake, and use homeopathics because they're so easy to take. You drop them in your purse, your briefcase, some liquid homeopathics, some drainage products to help the lymph move, to help the immune system be stronger and clear the garbage out of the
right.
cells.
Well, I think it's fair to say there's a lot you can do,
mm-hmm.
and there's a lot you can do to build your strength and defenses. And then if we do, as we do, experience radiation, and I guess it's fair to say we're you know, it's happening all the time. There's a lot we can do to mitigate the impact of it.
Absolutely.
So the thing to do is to just start to gain knowledge about these things and just start trying them and find the ones that work for you.
Yeah, exactly, because it's always going to be different, and people are going to do things in different orders, and parents are going to know what's best for their kids, and it just, you know, it just has to do with just talking to your body.
Right. Well, I know you've seen a tremendous amount of successes. I wanted to also mention, I put up a blog on the post on the blog about 2 weeks ago, an article by Robin O'Brien, who writes about the importance of eating fresh food. And she pointed out that Americans spend 9 cents out of every dollar on food, but we spend 16 cents on chronic disease. And she was making the argument that organic food is not expensive when you look at the 16 cents. And I know I've struggled as an investment advisor with my clients and said, look, if you've got money in corporate stocks, but you're not feeling absolutely healthy, don't tell me you can't afford it. You can. You can't afford corporate stocks. You can afford to get healthy. So I have to stress the importance of whatever it takes in terms of time and money, whatever you can do, go ahead and do it. Because I think this, you know, if we didn't have our wake-up call before this week was a wake-up call.
Absolutely.
That the environmental pollutions are going to continue. We're going to go through a period where they're going to continue to rise. And you can, I think the message is, in most circumstances, you can absolutely overcome phenomenal amounts of stress and toxicity, but you have to, we have to get educated and we have to learn what works for us and take action. So
it just takes a little shift, you know,
and
I think you're right about, you know, from the financial perspective, you know, the old adage about, you know, you just forget the Starbucks and the scone and just look at how much money you have left.
Right.
To do better things with.
Right. I agree. Okay, well, Laura, thank you again very, very much for joining us on the Celery Report. We really appreciate it. Have a wonderful evening, and I will be in touch with your office shortly.
Okay, yeah, thank you so much, too, Catherine,
for
all that you're doing, and I had a great time.
You'll be back. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, that's it for this evening. That's our special report. March 24th next week, we have 4 Celery Reports this month because it's a 5-week month. Gwen Scott, mitigating the harm to your health as a result of aerosol spraying. She's worked a great deal with Cliff Carnicom on the chemtrail phenomena. And because of the specials we did with Clifford on chemtrails, we've gotten a lot of requests for that. April 7th, very important, our first quarter wrap-up. If you haven't yet read the year-end wrap-up, I strongly suggest it to it. Again, go to your control panel and go to the first Celery Report in January 2011. And at the resource section, you'll find the PDF to the year-end wrap-up, and it's a description of the big trends we see, and I'll be bringing that up to date. A lot to talk about in the first quarter wrap-up. If there are things you want me to cover, please send your suggestions. April 14th, Precious Metals with Franklin Sanders. I will absolutely have researched and have an answer prepared on the Zurich Canton ETF if I don't have it for next week. So there's a lot cooking. Please remember, until we meet again next week, don't worry about whether or not there is a conspiracy. If you're not in a conspiracy, then you need to start one. Good night and good luck.